Fire-Breathing Kittens is an actual play, one-shot podcast that plays various tabletop role-playing games with a season-long plot. Because there's a beginning and an end to each week's story, you can start at any episode. Every week has a different combination of four from the same rotating cast group of people. Join Fire-Breathing Kittens as they solve detective mysteries, attempt comedic banter, and enjoy friendship.
Welcome to the Vocal Fries Podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa.
Once again, our patron from Patreon, Diego Diaz, has sent us a multitude of things to talk about.
So grateful for it.
But this comes from Metro in the UK. Great British Bake Off fans slam offensive comments about contestant. And there's a contestant named Tasha. And I guess some viewers took aim at her because she was using BSL or British Sign Language.
Okay, what? I mean, well, okay, tell me about it. Because I'm just like, why? Why?
I mean, come on, we know why. But
I mean, yeah, ultimately know why. But
yeah, so she's from Bristol and she's the first ever deaf contestant. And the presenters learned some sign language so that they could communicate.
Oh, that's
But true. She also had an interpreter with her named Daryl.
Daryl. Okay. Well, yeah, I guess they would have to have an interpreter because, I mean, there's only so much they can learn to communicate with her. And
On the fly, like really quick. Yeah, there's only so much you can learn.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it's nice that they tried, but it's also better that obviously there is an interpreter.
Right.
I guess because she decided to sign rather than speak, a bunch of people were riled up.
From what I gather from the deaf community, it's also a privilege to be able to have speaking privilege.
Well, yeah, not all deaf people can speak.
Exactly.
Some can.
Right.
But I guess she can because she said when she was explaining the cake to, like, the cake that she made, apparently this had elderflower and hibiscus flowers on it. Sounds kind of fun.
So
when she was explaining the cake to the judges, she said, okay, I'm going to be signing now. So she probably was talking a little bit during the like preparation of her things.
Right.
Of her concoctions.
Yeah.
And she said, I'm going to be signing because I don't feel comfortable pronouncing quite a few words.
Completely fine. Reasonable. I mean...
Okay, but her cake had 10 layers. My word.
Oh, my word. I'm going to have to go back and see this cake. I bet you it's beautiful.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
She explained, like, described her 10-layer creation, and so Daryl was interpreting for her. And then they went to speak to some of the other bakers, so she then signed to the camera. She was trying to decide whether she should reduce the number of layers of her cake. But then she's like, nah, I'm going to continue. That's when the viewers were like, well, why were you signing? You were talking before. And one person said they were, quote, confused by her decision.
That's not for you to, I mean... Who gives a shit that you were confused?
So weird. It's so weird. Like, fine, you're confused.
Whatever.
That's fine. You're allowed to have that feeling.
Yes.
Sometimes things confuse you and you don't know why. But, like, you're going to express this online? Like, everybody needs to know about your internal state at any given moment?
Right. I mean, that's another thing where it's like, we don't need to know. Not everyone needs to know what's going on with your inner monologue.
Yeah, you are not, your main character syndrome is too much. Just calm down. Go to bed.
Yes, instead of being online and griping about this, just go to bed. Just go to bed. Oh my God. And
obviously some people were defending her.
Yeah.
I can't believe people are still tweeting. But anyway, someone on X/Twitter.
Right.
The sheer ignorance shown regarding Tasha and why she is mostly using BSL this episode is absolutely staggering. I implore people who have a similar attitude as this to educate yourself on deafness / hearing loss before sharing your ill-informed opinion. As someone else said, very upsetting to see people criticizing Tasha for her decision to sign. Deaf people are entitled to communicate however they want and feel comfortable, and that doesn't always need to be one way or another. If it bothers you that you can't understand, learn BS or BSL.
Yeah, amen. I mean, yeah, they are entitled to communicate in any way they want to, and I'm wondering if in other episodes she speaks much more.
I have a feeling that at the beginning of the episode she was speaking, and then she made the switch.
Yeah.
When she was trying to describe her cake, because she was like, okay, this is too much for me. Like, there's too many words that I don't know how to say. And then once she made that switch, it was probably just, she was just comfortable.
Okay, right.
I'm just going to communicate this way, at least for the, you know, few minutes afterwards. Like, it totally makes sense.
Especially in that, like, high chaos environment. I mean, it's chaotic if anyone's ever, they're being timed. They're trying to do these very intricate, elaborate things. And, you know, everyone's running around and rushing around. And there's a camera. I mean, all of these things. It's no surprise, like, wow, that she was trying to, you know, like, speak in the first place if that is not, like, her most comfortable state of being, state of communicating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just, like, think about that. Be more thoughtful. Why can you not be more thoughtful? Is it that hard?
I mean, maybe, but I just think, at least maybe think to yourself, is this something that I need to share? Do I really need to show my ass right now?
Yeah, we've talked about this before, because you and I have things that we find annoying about language, but, you know, like, you know, just like everyone else does, but we keep it to ourselves.
Anything.
Or anything. Yeah.
There are many thoughts that I have that are churlish. I do not need to be spreading them. I do not.
Right.
It's okay that I have them, because I'm a human being and we're allowed to have shitty emotions.
Yeah.
Or shitty feelings.
We're but, going like, to.
Spreading them is really like, is this necessary? Like, that's, you know, maybe you have a really close friend that you can share those really shitty thoughts with.
Yeah.
So that you're not just getting them off your chest. But, like, spreading them around the world, the planet. Like, why?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe you have a friend or a therapist or something. Someone can.
Yeah, maybe a therapist is better.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I really just think that most people have main character energy. They really think that every thought they have is, like, worthy of sharing. And, like, no.
Yeah, maybe that's the main problem here. Oh, that's wild. And it's wild to me, and of course it's not surprising, but that it's their first deaf contestant. And how many seasons? So many seasons.
And Tasha also said that she found it very emotional to see Daryl among the rest of her co-stars. So, quote, it was a big moment when Noel introduced not only Allison, but also Daryl as part of the lineup. Seeing Daryl up at the front and feeling fully part of the show was a really special moment.
Oh.
She said she went on to explain she couldn't have competed without him.
Oh, I just got chills.
And, quote, without the dedication from the show ensuring I had the same access as the other bakers. Yeah, so, like,
oh, good.
You know, shitty internet commenters, I guess, thank you, because now I get to hear about this and, like, see her perspective, because I doubt I would have seen this.
Yeah, and it makes me want to watch the show, honestly. I mean, I've seen it before. I've seen previous seasons. But to go back to it and watch. And it sounds like they did a good thing and actually made the environment accessible.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that it seems like they did the right thing, so that's great.
Yeah, Tasha, I'm glad to hear your perspective, and fuck the haters.
Fuck the haters.
Yes.
Okay, but
speaking of fuck.
Now, before we get to that even, I would like to thank our newest patron at patreon.com, Henry.
Thank you so much, Henry. We appreciate it. So much.
Yes.
So much. We appreciate all of our Patreon supporters.
Yes, we really do. And they do help us pay for the editing and for the transcriptions. So, anything that you send our way goes to other people. So
yes.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
And now, speaking of fuck,
we get to talk about swearing today, which is one of our favorite topics.
yes. And I don't know why, but I didn't think I would learn that much because we've talked about swearing before. But turns out, no, I was wrong.
I know.
We learned.
We always learn. And that's, you know, hopefully we pass on some learning to you as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's great.
It is great. So enjoy. So today we have Rebecca Roach, who is a senior lecturer in philosophy at Royal Holloway, University of London. She is co-editor of Psychiatry Reborn. Her work has appeared in places like BBC, The Guardian, The Times, Harper's, MIT Technology Review, Eon, and Slate. Her podcast, The Academic Imperfectionist, draws on philosophy to deal with things like self-doubt and procrastination. She's also the author of For Fuck's Sake, Why Swearing is So Shocking, Rude, and Fun. And that's why we're here right now to talk about that. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. This is the first interview where somebody has actually said the full uncensored title of the book.
Oh, really? How funny.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of talking about swearing without actually swearing.
Oh, so. Feel free to swear to your heart's content here.
Yeah, I was going to say, okay. I mean, thank you for being here so that we can swear so much. We usually do. We always have an explicit rating, but yeah, we get to swear even more. So do you introduce your book as For F's Sake in other interviews or?
Well, it's usually not me introducing it. It's just the whoever's interviewing is kind of just stumbling over how to say it without upsetting anyone.
Well, that reminds me, this is a while ago now, like we're talking early 2000s. I was listening to CBC Radio and the woman just could not say vagina monologues. She just couldn't do it. And I was so embarrassed on her behalf because I was like, it's a perfectly fine word. It's not like it's cunt.
Right. At least cunt in Canada and not in like England, right? Because that's different. Although, would you say cunt on the radio in England?
No, people don't say that. It's weird. It's a word that has sort of different connotations in different places. So there's places in the UK where you can use it pretty much benignly. I mean, it's vulgar, right? But it's, you know, so it can be affectionate, but not really sort of Southeast England and even worse in the US.
Oh, way worse.
It has a sort of different connotation there. So, yeah.
Right off the bat, we want to ask, why did you want to write this book? What drew you to swearing?
So the first time I can remember being interested in it was, I write about this in a book, but over the past decade or so, there's been this sort of real proliferation in predatory academic journals. So journals with sort of impressive sounding names, but they just sort of spam people asking for articles. And then they'll publish pretty much anything as long as you pay the publication fee. And it made the news that an article had been accepted. And it was called, I can't remember what the name of the journal was, but it was one of these journals. The title of the article was Get Me Off Your Fucking Mailing List.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole thing was just, it was just that repeated and repeated, but it was formatted like a scientific paper. And I saw a story about this. I can't remember where now. And the headline was censored. So it was sort of Get Me Off Your ING mailing list. But the article was illustrated with a picture, like a screenshot of the article where you could just see all these fuckings everywhere. And yeah, I started thinking about that. I was thinking, how does that work? Like it really does. It does seem to work to include asterisks in swearing to censor it. But you know, we all know what it means. And usually that's the whole point, right? It was a story about this article. So, you know, how's that working? So I looked around and tried to see if any philosophers had written about this and nobody had. So I thought, okay, I'll do that then. So I just sort of dived into swearing from there.
that's great. I had completely forgotten about that article, but as soon as you said it, I was like, oh yeah, that was such a brilliant fuck you. Such a brilliant fuck you. So
yeah,
let's start. Yeah, even very basically, what is swearing and why is it interesting?
Yeah, I suppose a few things characterize swearing. I mean, I guess, so everyone who's listening is going to sort of have a list going through their mind. You know, we sort of all know what the words are. So it's taboo language. So language that, well, it's interesting. It's taboo in two ways. So, I mean, taboos are just topics that are informally prohibited. So things you wouldn't mention in polite company. So swear words are taboo in the sense that you shouldn't say them in polite company, or that's what we all tend to think. And they're also taboo in the sense that they center around taboo topics. So things like sex, defecation, religion, disease. So that's one feature of it. Swearing is taboo, but it's not, you know, there's plenty of things that are taboo that aren't swearing. There's plenty of language that's taboo, but not swearing. So there's a few other features of it too. One is that it seems to have this particular role in helping us express emotion. So, you know, that experience of just stubbing your toe on the table leg and sort of, Or swearing at people when you're driving. According to my kids, this is where they pick up their swear words.
I believe that.
So there's that too. It seems to have this weird, unique role in the brain. It seems like, so there's a condition where, you know, if people have a brain injury or a stroke, they can lose the ability to use language. But they will often retain the ability to say certain things, and that might include swearing, along with things like, I mean, it's psychologists call it automatic speech, but reciting the days of the week, counting, saying this sort of thing. So yeah, it seems to have this sort of interesting psychological role. And it's not always the case that we swear in order to offend people, but that's kind of part of what swearing is for. I think, you know, sort of part of what it's for is to break taboo and shock people. So there's that as well. I think that's an interesting feature of it. You know, we have plenty of things that we're not supposed to do, but usually when we shock people by breaking the rules, it's not usually by doing something that's been designed to shock people and upset them and so on. So yeah, I could go on, but there's this sort of cluster of features that define swearing, I think.
I think I'm thinking about using it as shocking. We, Carrie and I, host a podcast. We're two women. And, you know, that is a unique place to be in podcasting world in the first place. And to have an explicit show where we actually allow, you know, swearing, I think that, I guess, yeah, it could be considered shocking to some. I don't think we're meaning to offend in this case, but more to be kind of that shocking, use that shocking factor.
Yeah, I mean, there's long been this taboo around women and swearing, I think, you know, that in the sense that, well, in a few senses. So there's the fact that the strongest swear words tend to be words that have to do with women's bodies. And also, you know, the taboo against swearing in front of women, and especially women swearing. You know, there are still some people who will be shocked by that. I actually remember when I was writing the book, which took me far too long, I was about to pick my kids up from school, and I'd arrived a little bit early. So I nipped into the pub round the corner and just had a cup of tea. Let's say it was a cup of tea. and I had my laptop on, and I was making progress on my book. And it was like sort of mid-afternoon. It was really quiet in there, but there were these two old guys sitting at the bar, just sort of nattering. And at one point they swore, and then they kind of noticed that a lady was present, and they turned around and go, "Oh, sorry, love." And I was literally writing a chapter called Cunt at the time.
which would have offended or shocked them.
This was like, gosh, that surprised and alarmed them. I didn't mention it, but yeah, that was kind of fun.
I know exactly what you're talking about, that whole, oh, excuse my French, or sorry that I'm saying this in front of a lady, or, you know, it's the lady. You bring out the word lady. I feel like that happens too.
I feel like that happens a lot less now here, at least, like in North America. I remember when I was a kid that would happen a lot, that there'd be men apologizing to women for swearing in front of them. And I don't hear it very much at all anymore.
I think it's a generational thing, right?
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's also a sort of ambiguity. So for men who kind of want to do the right thing, they're probably thinking something like, you know, I'm in the company of this woman, maybe a woman who I don't know that well. Should I just go ahead and swear because I don't think that women's ears are more delicate? So, you know, it's a sort of motivation from equality. Or is it that, you know, is it the fact that she might then think me a bit aggressive and be alarmed by it, in which case I'd better watch my language, because there's this whole background of ways in which women are alarmed by men's behavior.
For sure.
So I think it's tricky. It's tricky to know what to do to break down these taboos, because they certainly seem like ones that need to be broken down. But sort of how to do that is not always easy to work out.
So what are some of the factors that affect whether or not swearing is offensive or shocking or acceptable?
Yeah, I think this is a sort of a whole can of worms. So, I mean, there's a sort of background of what the rules are in a particular social context. So if you are in a job interview or at a funeral or something like this, you probably ought not to swear. And if you are in a group of friends who you know well and you're all relaxed with each other and swearing is just something that you do perfectly benignly, then that's fine too. So there's different sets of rules that govern different situations. But I think on top of that, there are things like whether the swearing is directed at anyone versus just sort of punctuation. So fuck you would be worse probably in any context than oh fuck it, or you know, just something that's sort of directed at nobody in particular. So that directedness is a factor. How often it's repeated, you know, sort of once might be a slip of a tongue and you can get away with it in a polite context, but if you keep on doing it, then even if you apologize every time, that's probably going to end up shocking people. Things like sort of tone and body language. So I guess this is sort of a general point really about how we interpret other people's mood and their intentions towards us. But you know, somebody swearing really aggressively and sort of getting right up in your face, then that's going to be more alarming than if they are sort of relaxed and, you know, not angry or in the grip of any strong emotion. You can just stop me when I've said enough, because I'll just go on. But I also, you know, sort of who's doing the swearing. So, you know, there's some people who it's kind of more on brand, I think. We tend to have this thing in newspapers in the UK where if a member of the royal family swears, it will just instantly make headlines. Even if it's somebody that you, I mean, the late Prince Philip was just sort of notorious for just sort of speaking without thinking, just sort of saying really controversial things. And yet still, if he swore, even in a fairly uninteresting way, it would still make headlines the next day. And people are kind of delighted by it, by that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think about how our US President Joe Biden, it wouldn't be shocking if he cussed, because he kind of does that. Like, I feel like he has, and it hasn't been taken as seriously if, like, say, President Barack Obama had.
Right.
That, like, there's, you know, different things going on there.
Definitely could get away with it more, but I don't think I've heard him swear.
Really?
Like, malarkey, that's not swearing.
Am I confusing malarkey and thinking that he said something stronger than malarkey? I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. I just personally can't think of anything. It doesn't mean that he hasn't.
That's true. But this even brings up the point of who we imagine in our heads would get away with swearing, right?
Yeah. It's interesting, actually, that the issue of politicians and swearing, I'd need to look this up to say anything sort of definitive about it. But I'm sure that a few years ago, there was a study looking at people's attitudes to politicians swearing, which found that when politicians swear, it can make them seem more trustworthy and more human, I guess. But this was done before Trump. And I'm sort of interested to know, if they did that study again, would the results be different? Because he was really someone that you sort of thought that what he was saying was barely bypassing his prefrontal cortex.
Right.
It was just it was sort of so thoughtless.
Yeah.
That I wonder in a case like that, whether the conclusion might be, you've got no idea what you're talking about, have you?
Right. But then also partisan politics would play into that too. So you would expect like MAGA types to be like totally okay with like whatever speech Trump does. But it's hard to know for sure because, yeah, the study would need to be done.
Yeah. Somehow making someone who's like rich seem more down to earth somehow if they already bought into his politics, I think. It's a good point. And I'm thinking, again, like female politicians wouldn't be able to get away with swearing in the same way. Certainly black politicians, indigenous I know it's a small population of our politicians, but just thinking about all the ways that they would not be able to get away with this because it would seem unprofessional.
And there's a class issue here as well, I think. There was a case about a decade ago in the UK where a Conservative MP, Andrew Mitchell, who was, I guess he was, you know, sort of older white guy, he was cycling past 10 Downing Street and a police officer outside there asked him to get off his bike. And he responded in a sort of derogatory, I can't remember exactly what he said, but part of it was calling them fucking plebs.
Ooh.
And he, and that's a really, you know, so that I think is a really, a particularly nasty type of swearing because, you know, the word plebs is a slur for the lower classes in the UK. I mean, nobody really uses it apart from apparently older conservative politicians. But, you know, he didn't face any, there was a fuss in the press about it, but he didn't get arrested. And sort of by comparison, I think around the same time, there was a black teenager in London who swore while he was getting searched for drugs by police officers in London. He didn't have any drugs on him, but he swore and in not an aggressive way at all, he said something like, oh, I told you you wouldn't fucking find anything or something like that. It was sort of swearing in the course of what he was saying. And he got arrested and convicted.
Convicted of what?
It was later overturned, but I think, you know, it still really brings out this sort of class and sort of, in that case, I think racial double standard.
Yeah, so that brings up the question of who gets to swear and who doesn't. And and is that very, it's very contextualized.
Yes, it is. And it's, you know, there's a serious point here because on the one hand, it's sort of, you know, oh, isn't it funny that men are so shocked when, or sort of certain men of a certain age, as you put it, are so shocked when women swear. But I think that there is this sort of serious issue behind it, which is that it shouldn't be the case that some groups pay a higher price for swearing or using any sort of expression compared to other groups. You know, something like swearing should be, if it's available to anyone, it should be available to all, and we should all suffer the, whatever the consequences might be in a particular situation. It shouldn't really matter who you are, but no, that's not the world we live in.
It's absolutely not.
It sure isn't. So what are some of the ways that the powers that be have tried to regulate swearing, and do they work?
So, well, let me continue with the, you know, sort of what I was talking about a couple of minutes ago about, you know, this sort of double standard of swearing in the UK. So after Denzel Cassius Harvey, the black teenager who was convicted of swearing during a drug search by police officers, and then his conviction was overturned. The overturning of the conviction was really controversial, you know, because there was a sort of reaction in the press about, you know, sort of got these yobs just going around swearing at police officers and getting away with it. And Boris Johnson, you know, who later became prime minister, but he was London mayor at the time. And in the sort of fallout from this, he pledged a zero tolerance approach to swearing at the police.
Jesus Christ.
And then a few years later, he was filmed, I think, on his bike, shouting at a taxi driver in London, "Why don't you fuck off and die?"
Ooh.
So, yeah, I mean, I write about this in the book. It's sort of like there's so much going on there. I mean, what is it? Is it that he thinks the rules don't apply to him? Is it, I mean, that's probably.
Yes, the answer is yes.
My money would be on that. But yeah, no, is it that if it's a police officer, it's not allowed, but unless you're Andrew Mitchell, but if it's a taxi driver, it's fine? Or, you know, what's going on? There just seems to be this ridiculous set of, just a mess. And actually sort of across the pond, you know, in the US, that's a couple of decades ago, an attempt to introduce something called the Clean Airwaves Act, which would forbid the broadcast of certain words. And it was just sort of a list of swear words. And that didn't get through. But there's just a mess of double standards and sort of confusing precedents when you look at how lawmakers and broadcasters and so on have tried to, you know, regulate swearing. So there was a law professor, an American law professor called Christopher Fairman, who sadly no longer with us, but he wrote one of those really long law journal articles. They tend to be sort of like 60 pages long, but it was called Fuck. And it was just exploring all the weird double standards and conflicting decisions about this word. So one thing I tried to do in the book is try and sort of, okay, just set out a structure for making sensible decisions about this. Because I think what's going on, the reason why this tends to be so confusing is that when people swear and we don't like it, our reaction is kind of knee-jerk. You know, we're not necessarily thinking, oh, why am I so shocked? Would I be shocked if it had been this person swearing rather than this other person swearing? What if it was in a different context? We just sort of react in a knee-jerk way. And I suppose, you know, especially if you are a lawmaker or sort of an organization that regulates broadcasting, there's this pressure to do something about it, right, to uphold the standards of society. But I think because it's so kind of knee-jerk and intuitive, it often doesn't make sense. And there's a lot of, you know, sort of, because it's not sort of rationally thought through and the underlying principles analyzed, there's a load of sort of stuff that's smuggled in with these decisions. So, you know, bias, just misjudgments, all the rest of it.
What kind of biases?
Well, I think, you know, so part of it would be things like people from a certain race or class or gender paying a higher price for swearing than others. We've seen that, you know, that comes out in some of the examples I already talked about. But also, I think, you know, if you look around, there's plenty of research on implicit bias. So things like Black men tend to be viewed as more threatening than white men, even if they're a similar size. And this is especially if white people are doing the viewing. I mean, there's loads of stuff like that. Job applicants with a female-sounding name or a sort of ethnic minority-sounding name are less likely to get a job interview than people with a sort of more majority male name. There's lots of really disturbing studies like this. And you know, a reason why it's so disturbing is that, you know, even when you have people who are trying to do a good job, so say recruiters who are trying to make their decisions in a fair way based completely on somebody's qualifications and experience, these things do end up affecting us, whether we like them or not. And so I think, you know, when we're offended by swearing, especially if, as is often the case, we don't stop to think why we're offended by swearing, then it's just sort of opening the door for all these sorts of judgments to come in. I think it's, you know, it's really maybe not so worrying when it's just about in fairly kind of low-key context where the worst that's going to happen is somebody will sort of clutch their pearls. But, you know, when it comes to people being fined and arrested and all this, then it is much more of a justice issue.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about the US, and like, it's not the case that people are getting arrested for, let's just use Black men because they're disproportionately arrested for swearing, but they are seen as the quote unquote angry Black man. Or if they swear, it gets them in, well, they don't get themselves in the situation, but the perceiver who may be white or even, you know, Black themselves may see, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. So people from a minority group can internalize the same prejudices as everybody else. But yeah, and I think, you know, what you said there is important, that often it's not people being penalized for swearing explicitly. It's kind of an inference. So there might be, you know, a rule about behaving in an antisocial way or disturbing the peace or acting disrespectfully. But whether or not you view swearing as any of those things is going to depend on a load of other factors. So, you know, if it tends to be the case that Black men are viewed as, or I think Black people in general sort of tend to be viewed as angry when they're just behaving in a way that if it was a white person, nobody would think there was anything amiss. I mean, if that's the case and you get sort of a Black person swearing versus a white person swearing, then it looks like it's going to be the case that the Black person's more likely to be interpreted as swearing in an especially objectionable way and might end up paying a penalty for that.
Right. Even in situations where it might be a moment of camaraderie, like in the workplace, when there's maybe some swearing, will Black people or other people of color be viewed differently when they're swearing in the situation? Even though it's like a moment where maybe the person that has the more power did swear, they still run the risk, I think, of being viewed differentially.
Yeah. And I was actually talking to a friend the other day who so a female friend who actually ended up on her HR record of her boss saying that she swears too much. So this was in the US, maybe in a context where it's sort of quite a religious corner of the culture. And so, you know, there is this dislike of swearing. But, you know, I did sort of find myself wondering whether that would have happened if she was male.
I do wonder. I mean, I've never gotten in like trouble like that, even though I do swear quite a bit. But in a particular part of the States, that, yeah, I probably would have gotten myself into trouble and probably a man wouldn't. But yeah, we can't prove it.
Yeah, exactly. That's a frustrating thing a lot of the time, isn't it?
We can't
prove it. Well, we probably can, but it would take some time. We can't do it in this exact moment. But
No, you can't magic it out of thin air.
What are some ways that people like try to mitigate the offensiveness of swearing, and why do people feel the need to do it?
Yeah, there's a few interesting ways. So we talked about one of them right at the beginning, which is using asterisks to replace some of the letters in swearing. And then, of course, people will do things like say funk instead of fuck, or, you know, whatever. You know, there's sort of usual...
Oh, by the way, before we get too far away from the asterisk, book is amazing in that it has the asterisk, but it also, like, in...
Yeah,
the same color.
It's barely sensitive. Yeah. I was so happy that OUP did that, that they've taken such a light touch to the censorship on the cover. And also, you know, if you look at the, because you can look at the list of chapters on the OUP website. And, you know, there's a lot of the chapter names. There's one called Cunt. There's one called Cunt and Cunt, or Cunt in inverted commas. I was sort of really, you know, there was a sort of process of writing the book and then thinking, okay, like what form is this going to end up being published in? But no, they were so great.
Sorry about that. Go ahead. Yeah.
No. So yes, we were talking about sort of the ways that we mitigate the damage of swearing, however you might interpret damage. I think, so this is really puzzling. I mean, as I said, this was what first drew me into swearing. You know, why do we do this? You know, why do we censor swear words when we're doing it in a way that makes sure that people can still understand what the word is, right? You could just, you know, fuck is rarely censored by replacing all of its letters with asterisks. You know, there's enough left to kind of give people the idea. I think it becomes less puzzling when we kind of take a step back and look at why swearing, like what makes swearing offensive. It doesn't all have to do with the words themselves. It's not like those words have this power to offend and nothing else is going on. I think one of the reasons that swearing can be so offensive is because it's not always, but it can be like an overt expression of disrespect. If you say a swear word in a sort of in a context, it's obviously polite and you know that nobody's going to want you to swear and you swear anyway, then I think what's going on there is the people you're talking to take that as an expression of disrespect because they know that you know that they're not going to like it, you know, that they're going to be shocked by it. And yet you go ahead doing it and do it anyway. So they end up thinking, okay, I guess you don't care very much about my feelings. I mean, there's more to say about that, but I think going back to asterisks, what we're doing is sending. So there's that message that we would send if we chose to use a swear word without censoring it. I mean, this would be in writing now. And by doing that, we would be sending that message of disrespect. But when we obscure some of the word with asterisks, I think there's this other message that we're sending, which kind of balances out that disrespectful message. And it's something like, you know, there's reasons why I want to communicate this word. You know, perhaps it's if it's a news report, say I want to report accurately what's been said, not leave you guessing. But at the same time, I care about how you might receive this and how you might react to it. So I'm going to censor some of the letters as a way of showing that I care about your feelings. And I think that's what people hear when they or see when they see a, I call it sanitization, when they see a sanitized swear word, you know, one with some of the letters replaced by asterisks, that there's that message of concern and consideration which balances out the message of disrespect. And I think that really comes out if you think about what it would be like. So I mean, generally when you see in a news report, say, a swear word with some of the letters replaced by asterisks, it will just appear once or twice, you know, just enough to kind of the bare minimum to let you grasp the facts. But if it was throughout the news article, you know, if it was just like peppered throughout pretty much every sentence, then I think the asterisk wouldn't do so much of a good job, because I think, you know, this message of I care that you don't like swearing would be kind of in conflict with the fact that it's every other sentence, right? So I think, if asterisks are used and they're used sparingly and in a sort of this hurts me more than it hurts you sort of way, then, you know, you can convey this, okay, I care about accuracy. I want you to understand this thing that I'm communicating, but at the same time, I don't want to offend you. And I think that's what's going on. And I think it kind of works partly because of that, but also because when we read a swear word with asterisks obscuring some of the letters, we understand all this, right? We understand that it's being used as a technique to make sure we don't get upset.
That's interesting, because I kind of get annoyed, not all the time. In some instances, I understand why they're using the asterisk, but I guess like on social media, like we're all friends here. Why are you sanitizing?
Yeah.
And I guess I'm offended that they think I'm going to be offended or something. I'm not sure what's going on.
you're bringing up a really good point there, I think, which is that, you know, we all know that swearing can be a way of offending people, but I think we also all know, but maybe think about it less, that it can also be a way of establishing trust and intimacy. You know, if you think about going out with a new group of people who you don't know that well and getting to know each other, and then there might be a moment when somebody takes the risk and swears in a benign way, and everyone sort of goes, oh, okay, we can relax. But then everybody sort of, there's this sort of building up of trust because they've taken a risk and trusted you not to take offense, and you're happy with that and so on. And I think in that sort of context, so if you imagine sort of being invited to join a new group of friends who swear with each other, and whenever you're with them, they make sure to hold back and they don't swear. I think that can be quite excluding, right? That sort of you're not one of us. Because it does have that, it is that way of sort of signaling trust and intimacy. Yeah, so I think absolutely, it can, using asterisks can be annoying sometimes, right? You know, for exactly that reason. It's like, do you not trust me to react sensibly to this world?
Yeah.
This reminds me of an example of purposefully not sanitizing a word, and going back to politicians, when Donald Trump used the term shithole countries, I remember specifically some journalists choosing to actually say shithole countries and saying that their choice was to purposely say what he said. It seems to me maybe like a matter of like trying to convey that Trump's disrespect there, not the journalist trying to be disrespectful, but conveying someone else's disrespect.
Yeah. That's a good point. And I think that as well, this is it's one of those ambiguous, risky contexts, isn't it? Because the journalist who's saying that, you know, they're sort of, it sounds like the intention there was, well, I'm not going to, you know, apologize for him. I'm not going to be the one to make this better. You know, he said it, he can live with it. So yes, it's this way of sort of let him suffer the consequences of what he said. But at the same time, you know, that journalist is risking people thinking, you know, pinning the offense on him, right? Sort of thinking, okay, do you not know that this word is not one that we use in this context?
It's true, but like sanitizing, it really doesn't help that much because the meaning is still vile.
Right.
Yeah.
And you wonder what they would say otherwise. I mean, do you spell it out?
It would just be the asterisk, I think. I don't think you can.
Well, I think when it was on the banner or whatever they call those, I've forgotten the word. I know there's a specific word, but it didn't actually say spell out shithole. But the journalist did say it.
I think there's some cases where, sort of sanitizing it can just send the wrong message. And there was an interesting case of this quite a few years ago in the UK where the footballer John Terry was in court. He was charged with racial abuse for allegedly calling another player a fucking black cunt. And in a lot of newspapers, what he said was reported with the word black left intact. You know, that's not a word that we censor, but fucking and cunt were obscured with asterisks. And people, you know, there were letters sort of around at the time, written to newspapers saying, no, this is just weird. I mean, so John Terry was on trial for racial abuse. It wasn't for swearing.
Right.
And it was, you know, that one word that if he hadn't included the word black, it would have just been sort of another sort of uninteresting example of swearing. But I think that was a case, you know, sort of I think that was an unsanitizable expression, mm-hmm. because yep. you couldn't have sanitized the word black. I think that would have sent a really kind of offensive message, right? That's not an offensive term. So I think that was a case of, well, you kind of just have, if you want to report this, you have to leave it as it is.
Agreed.
Because anything you do to it is going to make it worse.
Yeah, I totally agree. What are some positive things about swearing?
Yeah, like,
actually, you mentioned one of them, but are there other things?
Yeah. So there's we talked about the role of swearing in sort of friendships. Yes. So there's a few things. There was a few years ago, there was a series of studies by the psychologist Richard Stevens and his colleagues, where they looked at the capacity of swearing to help people withstand pain. So they had people hold a hand in a bucket of icy water and see how long they could keep it there. And there were various sort of permutations that this experiment took. They were either allowed to say nothing, or they were allowed to swear, or they were allowed to say a sort of fairly like a benign word, like table or book, something like that. Or they were allowed to say a sort of made up word that sort of sounded a little bit funny. I think one was twiz pipe. So they were sort of like made up words, but they were supposed to sound a bit silly. Looked at all these sort of different things that people could say while they were coping with pain. And they found out that when people were allowed to swear, then they were able to keep their hand in this icy water for longer than in any of the other cases. And it tends to work better, apparently, for people who don't usually swear. So, you know, if you're sort of someone who just swears all the time, then it doesn't have so much of an effect. But yeah, the thought was that it sort of, you know, swearing, especially when you don't do it, has this sort of physiological response attached to it, and it can help us withstand pain, which I suppose explains why we might swear when we hurt ourselves.
Yep.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, there is one view that swearing can help forestall violence. So, you know, when you, it's a violence-free form of aggression, basically. The idea is that you can kind of use strong language to vent your anger at somebody rather than hitting them, which is, I mean, I guess if we encounter somebody in the street just screaming swear words at somebody else, we're not going to necessarily think, oh, that, what a positive aspect of swearing that is. But, you know, if the alternative is that they are hitting each other, then it's maybe the lesser of two evils.
Right.
So there's a few things. And there's something I wrote about towards the end of the book, which is about how not everybody has the capacity to cause offense by swearing, that some people just can't get people to take offense. And this was something I got thinking about when I saw a blog post by a blogger who sadly died now, called Mel Baggs. So they were a disabled blogger, used voice software to speak. So yeah, they would sort of type, press a button in the machine that would sort of say whatever the word was that they wanted to say. And they wrote a post about how people can be really sort of not respect the boundaries of disabled people. So can get really kind of up close and sort of treat them really in quite a demeaning, patronizing way. And Mel Baggs said, you know, we have to have the ability to tell people to back off, basically. So they designed a page of their voice software that was all dedicated to telling people to back off. And it had various expressions sort of ranging from something pretty mild all the way to fuck off, which, you know, then they could use to tell people to give them some more space. But then they wrote about how they had trouble getting people to take it seriously, and that when they used the machine to say fuck off, that people would just laugh and say, look, this guy's cursing you. Using a machine, which was really not the reaction that was intended. And they wrote in this post about just frustration at not being taken seriously. And I think their expression was, I'm not real to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is really worrying. I think it's, you know, so not just people with disabilities can have a hard time causing offense with swearing. But there's other groups too. I think children, you know, sort of we often laugh at the swearing of children. And, you know, I don't think that's particularly concerning because they'll just grow up and they'll find their feet eventually. But, you know, sort of people with an unusual appearance or people who sort of an unusual sound, people with unusual accent. I think there's all sorts of groups where people might not be able to bring about the effect that they want through swearing. And so I was thinking about why this is. I think we should think about it more. I think there's, you know, sort of when we tend to think, well, we need to be careful about swearing because we'll offend people when we do it. And I think, well, for most of us, that might be true, right? But then that's kind of a privilege, and that there's people who don't have that ability. And I think it reveals some quite concerning attitudes, I think. I think it's, if someone swears at us and we don't take them seriously, you know, we're not offended, then it's probably because we're not viewing them as one of us. And in some cases, we ought to view them as one of us, right? If somebody's speaking to us using voice software, there's no reason that we shouldn't be including them in the community of speakers that we are participating in. Same with sort of speakers of people who've learnt our language as a second or third or whatever language. Yeah, and I think a general point here is that our patterns of being offended can reveal some quite deeply held attitudes towards people. And you know, sort of actually being able to offend some or taking offence at somebody is in a way kind of paying them a compliment, right? Because it's like saying, well, I care about whether or not you show me respect. You're part of the group of people whose respect I, you know, I'm keen to have. And then when it comes to certain other groups, we don't take offense maybe because we don't care whether or not we're respected by them. And I guess this is another set of attitudes. It's an implicit bias, I guess, where it's another set of attitudes that we don't necessarily notice. Because, you know, we might like to think we are overlooking differences and treating everybody equally, but then perhaps our attitudes, sort of who's capable of offending us and who isn't. I think, you know, the differences there might reveal something else that it's probably worth us paying attention to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I haven't thought about that very deeply, so I appreciate you bringing it up.
No,
and reading it in the book as well.
Yeah, it is something that I think we should talk about more. Like, yeah, who we're worried about having respect from. Because we often think, like, when I think about these kinds of things, like, we do often still want respect from people who are below us on the social hierarchy. But, like, this is someone who just is, like, outside of the social hierarchy or something. Like, children kind of are. And, like, what does that mean? Yeah, haven't given it enough thought, but very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's a weird thing about offending, a sort of offensiveness, that it's something we want to avoid, right? But if we kind of sit with it, I think, okay, there might be more to it than that.
Yeah.
I think the chats where I discussed this, I called the value of offensiveness. I kind of wanted to, it's towards the end of the book, I wanted to sort of end on a somewhat positive note.
Right.
But, you know, sort of, so even when you're causing offense, there's something positive to say.
Always good. Always good. I love it when I get a new perspective.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we hope for with the podcast too. So what makes swearing so interesting from an academic perspective?
Good question. I mean, I was amazed that it's pretty neglected by philosophers, or it was when I started writing the book. There's a big philosophical literature on other sorts of offensive language. So especially slurs, what makes slurs offensive and what they are. There's this big literature there, but swearing is sort of relatively neglected. But in other disciplines, there is quite a bit written about it. So psychologists have written about it, cultural historians, linguists, and so on. Yeah, I think it's one thing I find really interesting about it is that it's just not something we're ever taught. So, you know, we don't get a class from our parents. They sort of sit down and teach us how to swear. we're just told not to. And so we sort of pick it up from older children and things like this. And it sort of all feels a bit naughty. And then it's almost like there's no rules. So there's this, Steven Pinker, the linguist, I think it was him, wrote, sort of looking at some of the interesting linguistic features of swearing, he was sort of going through why He was talking about fucking is not an adjective, where he said, you know, if you say drown, this is a nasty example, drown the fucking cat. I don't like this example. I've got a cat on my lap.
Me too.
Yeah. So he said, you know, if that was an adjective, you'd be able to say drown the cat, which is fucking. But I'm actually thinking I misremembered here. I'm not sure this was.
No, that's what you said in your book.
I'm getting my linguist. Okay, no, that's okay, right. Okay. That's... Thank you. I'm glad somebody knows what I wrote in my book. So reading things like this that have been written by linguists about, you know, what you can and can't do with swearing, I'm reading it thinking, I'm not sure how I feel about this sort of way of talking about swearing, that you can't say this with the word fucking. You know, you can't say drown the cat, which is fucking. And I was thinking, well, who says? I mean, it's just this sort of, you know, it's this sort of like wild west of language where, you know, you can, I think, say anything. I mean, if you look at examples like the way that Scottish people reacted to Donald Trump when he insinuated that they had voted to leave the EU in the UK's Brexit vote, and just, you know, entire BuzzFeed posts devoted to like the elaborate, unusual insults that they had levied at him. And the character Malcolm Tucker, I don't know if he's so well known in the US, but the sort of character from the political comedy show The Thick of It, famous for coming out with these bizarre, sweary expressions.
I'm totally beyond the realms of your fucking tousle-haired, fucking dim-witted, compra fucking Henson. I don't just take this fucking job home, you know. I take this job home, it fucking ties me to the bed, and it fucking fucks me from asshole to breakfast. Then it wakes me up in the morning with a cup full of piss slung in my face, slaps me about the chops to make sure I'm awake enough so it can kick me in the fucking bollocks. This job has taken me in every hole in my fucking body. Malcolm is gone. You can't know Malcolm, because Malcolm is not here.
So, you know, sort of thinking about what makes the difference between swearing in a way that, you know, makes people think you can't do that, that's not correct, and sort of thinking, wow, what an unusual and creative way of swearing, which I've never heard before. Yeah, I'm not sure whether there is any systematic way we can draw a line there. And I suspect that a lot of it just depends on who's doing the swearing. So if somebody swears really creatively and they are an intelligent, fluent speaker, then I suspect, you know, I could be wrong, but I suspect we're more likely to think, oh, they know what they're doing. They're just being creative. Whereas if it's somebody that we think of, you know, so maybe somebody who is still to become fluent in the language, and if they use an unusual sweary expression, then maybe we're more likely to think, okay, they don't really know what they're doing.
Well, you've made me defend Steven Pinker, which is anathema. But anyway, the point is that if you were to say the cat, which is fucking, it would mean something completely different from that fucking cat. But it's still
true.
You can be very creative, still, yes.
This is James McCauley's point, that there's these two, he has these two senses of fucking, and he calls them fuck one and fuck two. And fuck one is the sense of fucking where it's sort of, it's basically just another verb, which is, I think the point you're making, that you would think it means, you know, drown the cat, which is having sex, is what you would think it would mean.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't think it would mean, you know, just drown the fucking cat. It would mean something
different. At least not in my particular grammar.
Yeah.
Is there anything that we didn't ask you that you would like to have our listeners think about before we let you go?
No, I think we've covered a lot. I think you've been really thorough, and I'm really grateful for your interest in the book.
Well, we love swearing.
We love swearing. Yeah, jinx.
And anything to really do with language, of course, we're always going to be interested in. So, yeah, thank you so much for coming and talking to us about this.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And we leave our listeners with one final message. Don't be an asshole.
Definitely. And don't be an asshole either, as you would say.
Thank you.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.